Hello, I'm Neil Sheff.
And I'm Katie Holmes, and this is the Don't Do That, Do This podcast, brought to you to share successful stories of growth stories, business owners sharing what they've been going through launching their businesses in the Middle East.
Today, we're excited to talk to John Martin St. Valery OBE about starting, growing and thriving in the region. John is a veteran Dubai expat who has lived in the country for more than 20 years and now advises a small group of fast growth businesses. This is the Don't Do That, Do This podcast. Please find us on social media and give us a like and follow.
We're really open to hearing from you as well. So if you have a story that you'd like to share, or there's somebody that you'd really like us to interview on the Don't Do That, Do This podcast, please let us know and stay tuned for all of our great podcasts launching from now and through the rest of the year.
This podcast wouldn't have been possible without the following teams. Rightfully for Storytelling and Thought Leadership, Studio Red for the quality podcast studio and video production, and Sherbet Lemon for branding, social media design and editing. John, welcome. Excited to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me.
So as customary for this podcast, we ask everybody what their favourite biscuit is. Would you like to share your favourite biscuit?
I can't tell you a story about them, but they do happen to be my favourite biscuit, and that's a ginger nut. It's a great dunker.
Yeah.
And it doesn't fall apart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Spice.
Practical and useful.
It's up there for me.
Is it really?
Yeah. It's
well, let's get this over with.
Exactly.
And have one.
I'm tempted to start dunking. Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
But focus on the interview.
Sure.
So, not the ginger nut. So, John, you've got an eclectic career. You've been in the region for a very long time. It'll be good just to get an understanding of your career over the last 20 years, in Dubai.
You're making me feel very old there, Neil.
25.
Thank you for that. Yes, 25. Yes. Yeah, so quarter of a century in Dubai. It's been quite a ride, certainly. Arrived here in Dubai in the late 90s. With a UK financial services business that wanted to set up an international division. And I always describe it as a bit sort of elbows down at the ministry trying to get things sorted out. It was pre-free zones other than the Jebel Ali port. So there was no international financial centre or anything like that. And I had a young family with me. The kids were 8 and 6 at the time. And the rest, they say, it's quite a story, which I don't want to bore you with. So ask me whatever you like.
So you sold your business in 2016.
That was a fast forward, wasn't it? You didn't want to.
Yeah. We just went straight to.
So I bought this company over from the UK.
Right.
And after a period of about 3 years, we built quite a team. We had registered and qualified consultants that were looking after clients for that business across the Middle East. During that time, we built this business, but then that company, for whatever reasons, needed to withdraw from the market about 3 years later. So that was really sort of good thinking time for myself and my wife. And I actually got permission to sell that business on in the market to another incoming business that wanted a plug and play operation. So they could come in, they had staff, offices, licenses, local partners, etc.
Can you describe what the business is?
And so that business was financial services. It was what they call in the UK a friendly society. So in other words, that all the members were shareholders, in effect. It was a very old, established British company, 1763. And for whatever reason, they decided to, or they had to close in 2001, typical when I was holding the reins over here. But it was great thinking time when another business came in and wanted to acquire that business for plug and play, as I said. So I stayed with that business for integration for about a year and formed the plan to create my own business that became Lynx Group in the region to help other companies coming in a similar situation. And then, fast forward to the exit in 2016. Again, it was an international business wanting to have a footprint here in the Middle East and chose Dubai in particular, and they acquired, again, a plug-and-play, as I would describe it, business. that we built, and gave them a great client book, staff, licensing, etc., etc.
John, when you were scaling your businesses, for those listening that are in that point now where they've got the company and they're starting to scale at pace, what advice would you give those business owners that are struggling with whether it's trust or control and how they're growing?
Look, I think it's like in any jurisdiction, I would say it's not terribly different here than it is in other parts of the world. But scaling a business is very different, perhaps, for an international business coming into a new market versus a startup. And you know, this has been a great platform. Well, Dubai, UAE has been a great platform for startup businesses. Now there, it's all about, I mean, if I go back to the BBG, British Business Group, well, one of the best pieces of advice I was given in the late 90s when I first landed here with no network was, John, you should join the BBG. And I thought, well, what is this? And it's a group of like-minded individuals, either owner managers or senior people within British businesses in the region, that are there really to assist each other. And that's how I grew my network. That's how I met the lawyer I wanted to deal with, the accountant, the recruiter, whatever it happened to be. So I would say to these businesses, it's absolutely crucial. In your home country, you have a natural network that sometimes you don't even really think about. But when you come into a new jurisdiction, it's really important to get embedded into the community. If that answers it, Katie, I'm not sure, because it really depends on the type of business.
Yeah.
Not necessarily, we can be sector agnostic here, but whether it's an established business from overseas looking to establish and expand, or a brand new business, it's quite a different nuance.
I suppose it's around when you've been from the very start and you've got such a clear idea on the strategy, and probably you were doing everything at the beginning for most. It's then in your recruitment and it's your hiring people. And is it easy to let go, to give the reins to somebody else that isn't the founder?
No, and I suppose, you know, going back a few steps, I was really fortunate in my business that I had a business partner. So it wasn't just, you know, all about John at all. Mm. And we were quite yin and yang, you know, different strengths, and didn't always agree to everything. There's no point having nodding dogs around the small boardroom table to start with and the larger one later on. But what we always had, this philosophy, and it's certainly something that had stuck with me from years before, about Richard Branson philosophy, which is, you know, surround yourself with people smarter than yourself, which was, that was very easy for me. But no, it was the importance of having a partner is good. It's, I think it's a very lonely place to be, particularly starting a new business. But yeah, having a clear strategy and a big goal to go for. We were fortunate with my business, or our business Links Group, that we'd found a niche or a requirement in the market that didn't exist for incoming businesses, because I'd experienced that myself. So we filled that gap and had quite a long period of time where it was, you know, we'd call it blue ocean. We were, you know, the only people doing it, and we were growing fast. So that business now and back then is all about the people.
Yeah.
Absolutely all about the people.
So you now work with a number of businesses. You talk about fast growth businesses, entities in the UK or outside of Dubai who are looking to enter this region. And can you just share a bit more about the work that you do with these businesses?
Sure. Yeah, I suppose in some ways I just couldn't let it go. You know, I was in this company formation and restructuring space, and it still interests me now. And as we all know, you know, this growing environment, the businesses coming into the market is quite extraordinary at a pace. So I wanted to stay in this sort of market entry solution space, if we call it that. But I've been going through a period of reverse mentoring with my son, actually. He's been saying to me, you know, he'd gone away to study, to work, get married, you know, have children, come back here and all the rest of it. We're working together now. And we decided to hone these, you know, the joint skills, if you like, different generational skills, to help a small number of companies that are looking to come to market, probably only two or three at any one time, generally well-funded businesses from outside that want to come into market but don't necessarily want to go fully fledged into setting up a business, hiring staff, taking offices. They want to win business first. So it's a slightly different model. We don't do the company establishment and things like that. There are many others in the market that do that. But it's more of a hand-holding and opening doors while there's a bit more gas left in the tank for these companies as they come into the market. And I'm finding it fascinating. We're sector agnostic.
Right.
And so that links in well with BBG as well, because, of course, we have companies from all sectors. And so, you know, every day is a school day.
Can you, and I think a lot of what you do for these companies are going to be highly relevant to the people listening in. Either they're in this region, they're going, how do I grow? How do I take it to another level? Or they're outside of this region going, I really want to grow. I really want to take things further and grow our footprint within GCC, MENA, et cetera. So can you talk through maybe an example where you're working with a client? And what are the two or three steps that you're taking for them? Or maybe there's a pattern across the businesses that you work with. And whilst these are well-funded, what are the two or three steps that you're taking with them that we could then apply to the audience listening in?
Well, I suppose to bring that right down to basics for any business, it's about growth and retention, isn't it? So in its simplest form, that's business development or sales, if you like. So I think there's a methodology in this market to be adopted sensibly, which is what I call the trickle-down or aggregator effect. So in other words, when you're coming into market or you're already here, you've established your business, rather than sort of be relying on knocking on doors as everyone else in your particular sector might be, develop a network that enables you to come in at a higher level and trickle down the opportunity to that business. So, rather than the bottom-up sales approach, it's this trickle-down or aggregator effect. You know, build a network that introduces you to other opportunities. It's the one-to-many sales approach, again, in its simplest form, where you're building a great relationship in one area, but it opens opportunities in multiple. That's what I'd call the aggregator effect.
Do you have a sector that, I mean, obviously you're saying sector agnostic, but is there a sector that you really enjoy working in or something that's new to you?
Certainly on the new piece, yes. And I smile because some people listening to this, if I mention the word tech or digital, they'll say, John, no, really? but it is fascinating and our lives, you know, are going in that particular direction. So when I say every day's a school day, there are a couple of tech businesses. One is in augmented reality and surgical training, for example. Just fascinating. You know, I'd never been even on the periphery of that sector before. And another payments type business, you know, coming in from the UK that transforms the way people use app-based applications. It's really interesting. So no is the answer. A long way of saying, again, we're sector agnostic. But I think any business that's interesting and has a goal that we can be part of and be part of that growth curve interests me.
So just talking about the partnership approach that you talk about, the trickle down. Mm-hmm. So someone like you, been in the region for tens of years.
Quarter of a century.
Quarter of a century. You've probably got a special Rolodex of contacts. You've probably got some really great contacts if you just go through your phone. But there's going to be all of these other people, including myself, who've only been in the region for a year and a half and new to the region, still building up your contacts. How do they take that approach to partnerships when they don't have those relationships? What would you do?
But again, it's back to the network. You know, as we were walking in here today, you were telling me about your business, and it's really interesting. And I'm thinking the Rolodex is spinning a bit. Trying so and so might be interested in that. But what I'm not going to do, and no one expects someone like myself to do this, is just go to the same people all the time with different opportunities.
Yeah.
You know, it's not watches, nylons, whatever you want to find. It's really, you know, what is best for, and I'm passionate about this, you know, what is best for Dubai, firstly, and what is best for that particular individual or business. And connections has to be the way to do it here. Mm. I mean, we see that, don't we, through the BBG, Katie? It's, yeah. That's what the group is there for, to help others succeed in business. So I'm not sure I've answered that correctly, other than to say, how do those people access opportunities? How do those businesses access opportunities? And it's through valuable networking. Mm. And not knocking on the same person's door all the time. That's
how yeah. Do you use LinkedIn for your own resourcing, and how much are you contacted through LinkedIn?
I actually use it a lot. Mm. I think I was a fairly early adopter to LinkedIn. I never did the Facebook thing or anything like that. I dabbled on Instagram, if anyone wants to look at John MSP done. That's fine. No, but seriously, for business here in particular, and I speak to friends and colleagues in the UK, for example, and it doesn't seem so prevalent or so important as far as building a network is concerned. However, on the flip side, what I've found in the last year or so in particular is that there's a lot of direct selling on LinkedIn, and you have to filter that. And sometimes it feels a bit uncomfortable. It's almost rude, isn't it? You think, I just can't respond to another 26-year-old life coach that, you know, wants to, point me in the right direction.
Reverse mentoring.
Oh, yeah, more. I actually do, yeah. Shot myself. Sorry, Jack. Shot myself in the foot. No, so LinkedIn, I found personally really valuable. And even when with our former business that we sold, exited, when we were making the decision as to how to next pioneer or innovate with that business, it was either going to be further expansion through acquisition or something like that, or to have a beauty parade of businesses that were interested in us. And the LinkedIn engagement at that during that sales process, as it became in the end, was tremendous. From the businesses that became very interested, from not just me as an individual, but or my business partner, but for the business here in the market that was obviously relevant to other global firms.
If you were to pick one thing that you would say contribute to your success in the region, what would you say?
Probably a ginger nut.
Maybe two things then.
Yeah. Okay. I think, generally it sounds a bit trite to, to put it out there, but, tenacity. You could have a goal. And I was very ambitious. When I worked for big companies in the past, that was my background. Well, my background was actually public service. I was in the Met Police for a number of years. So that was quite a different transition from going from the public service to private sector. But working, for big firms, I had to understand what their philosophy and their target was, and became quite, excited, animated about that. And I wanted to adopt that in my own business. I'm just going to work for the sake of it. I suppose in some ways I'm fairly old fashioned. I used to put my uniform on, which was my suit, go into an office that was fully staffed, everyone on time, and enjoyed that whole sort of atmosphere, but that drove the tenacity within me to think, we could really go to the next stage.
So going from that formality of getting your suit, being somewhere at a certain time, leaving, hopefully having lunch during the day, what did it feel like once you'd successfully sold the business?
Well, that's a really interesting one, because that was probably the one element I hadn't really thought through. I knew I wanted to do more. It wasn't as if I was exiting a business to then retire. I wanted to do something else. But the world had changed also, because I remained with the company that acquired us for 3 years, actually, to help develop their Middle East business. Then it was, proper time to step away. Then it was the pandemic. So no one was going to the office in their suit. So that became a sort of, it was a harsh but natural transition. But over the last couple of years, I have found that difficult, that discipline of because I don't need an office. We have a small number of really reliable, fantastic staff people that have been with me for a long time, but we don't need that office infrastructure for the type of work that we're doing. So if I'm honest, yeah, that's been the difficult part of the transition. But again, working with generally sort of younger people that don't see that as an issue at all, and particularly when I'm talking about tech businesses, you know, you'll know yourself, Neil, you know, you can be anywhere, really. Although nothing, in my view, replaces the face-to-face interaction. I remember back in the day when I was working in the UK, working for Citibank or Diners Club at the time, and it's when video conferencing first came in. And a lot of that business at Diners Club was predicated on business travel. That's what the payment mechanism was used for. And everyone said, well, that's the end of business travel. You know, and this is the mid-90s. Of course it wasn't. Because nothing actually replaced the face-to-face interaction. And I'm a big believer in that. Not for every stage of a process, but at some stage of maintaining, retaining a relationship, there's nothing better.
Yeah, we've felt the same with the BBG through the pandemic. We were the first to get back to live events. And I'm sure you remember that first event was, we were full, absolutely full with a huge wave.
People were desperate to get back.
Yes. Really, really desperate for the eye contact, not having to be told you're on mute. No cat avatars, all that kind of thing. So it feels a long time ago, but it has changed business, hasn't it?
It has. Oh, yeah, the landscape is different. Yeah, but I'm sure it's for the better. But there are some, like, old school rules that still exist, I think.
Yeah, I remember going, I think you felt like this as well in the UK, in London, when you went in the summer, where it felt like the buzz was back this time when I went back into London. Whereas a few years ago, it was, and I, you know, my career was in St. Paul's, Fleet Street, Canary Wharf.
Yeah.
Where there was like real, you know, hustle, bustle. And during the COVID and even a year, year and a half, 2 years after, really the city was struggling.
Yeah.
And this time when I went back, it was, buzz was there. There was tourists, there was people. And I remember when before we took the transition to move to Dubai, we came out to the region to check it out, and it was like nothing, you know, there was no COVID. Everyone was just walking around and just normally, and we're like, wow, this is great. And like you said there's nothing better than just being face to face, right? You could we talk about building your relationships, building up those partnerships. That one meeting is probably equivalent to at least 5 Zooms.
I agree.
You know, and you go deeper and you talk about family and you go off and whereas on a Zoom call, it's timed, it's mechanical, it's, you know, you're there for a purpose.
Yeah, you're right. It has its place, obviously, because it can speed certain levels of the process up.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, you're right. That it's interesting what you say when you came in to look at the market and felt it was still buzzing, because that must have been just as we sort of came out of, because it was a strict lockdown here, which was good.
Yeah.
It was great in my view. We're a compliant society here.
Yeah,
you know, and what government were telling us to do, we did. There's no argument about that. And then when we came out of it, as Katie said, there was a real hunger to get back to see people, not least, you know, family and friends. So yeah.
Do you think people are more accessible here when you talk about building relationships? Do you feel, well, it's kind of a question in two parts. Are people more accessible, and do you feel sometimes that your time can be taken up well in meeting people?
Yeah, I think, yeah, you know, not just my time, but anyone's time, where we go back to the Rolodex and the context that built up over a number of years. I think there is, you know, without putting a negative spin on this at all, sometimes you get a bit bombarded. Right. And as I say, you know, it depends what the nature of the person is, but if, you know, you don't want to be rude, but sometimes the direct selling here is quite full on.
Yeah. Do you feel there's more pressure to meet somebody that's come directly or someone that's been suggested by someone for you to meet?
Oh, yeah, interesting. Yeah.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I don't think it is. Referral.
Yeah.
But for me, always is king. And I think it doesn't really matter what sector you're in. Sometimes it's really refreshing. You know, you get a brand new approach and you think, oh, that's really interesting. And personally, I'd like to explore that further. Mm. Well, that person was impressive when I saw them give a speech or something like that. I'd like to talk to them. But for me to have someone just do that initial validation of, oh, you should speak to Neil, you know, really interesting business or whatever it happens to be, would you mind, you know, having a chat, having meeting for a coffee? For me, that I prefer that approach. Yeah.
So, John, you've got your family here now living with you, and you're a granddad of four?
Four, that's right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Tell us about, you know, even before this interview, we interviewed Chris and Amanda.
Yes.
Who are a couple, and they're CEO and COO, I believe, working in the business. So, you know, and that's mind-boggling for me because it's never worked with me and my wife. But at the same time, you've now taken that slightly further with your son as well. So what's that like? Living in Dubai with your family must be amazing.
It is. We're incredibly lucky, and it's probably the greatest achievement. But my greatest partner has been Carolyn, my wife, when we came here in the late 90s. As I say, the kids, Chloe and Jack, were 8 and 6.
Mm.
So they were sort of straight into school. Carolyn was a supportive wife, but not a business partner.
Mm.
And I think that has stood us in good stead. So the kids grew up here, went to great schools, which was quite difficult because it was expensive, you know, and you know, we all know that. So that was another...
it's not getting cheaper.
So it's another reason to be, you know, tenacious. I've got to pay the school fees, let alone rent or whatever it happened to be. But anyway, we got through that. And so the kids grew up mainly at school here. My daughter all the way through secondary school. My son went back to the UK for a while. Then post-school, they did their tertiary education back in UK and Switzerland, respectively. And then into the place of work where they happened to meet their hopeful life partners, husband and wife. And then through work opportunities, came back to Dubai.
Wow.
And started their families. So yeah, I've got two granddaughters, 7 and 5. And 2 grandsons, 5 and 2. And so we're completely blessed. But the working relationship dynamic within the family, with myself and my son, Jack, you know, that's new.
Mm.
And as I said, you know, we're both sort of feeling our way there. We both worked for larger organizations and then have now decided to come together. And again, it's a good yin and yang, as my previous business partner was. He's the boss, obviously.
I'm interested to know, we've all been here at different levels of time. You have been here for the longest. Do you remember the moment when you felt like this is home? Or does it? Doesn't it feel like?
No, that's really interesting because when we'd been here a couple of times, Carolyn and I, and the family, before we moved here in 98. And I came first in the summer of 98. And he said, well, you know, it can't get worse than this in July. And I was here for nearly 3 months. I went back a couple of times, but just to get myself established, and then the family followed for the school year. And I think when the family arrived here, we all had that feeling of, you know, we'd had a good life so far in the UK. Don't get me wrong, but felt, I suppose, on my shoulders, I had this is the opportunity. This is what I've got to do from a work perspective. But as a family, gosh, this is great. You know, the little school on Alwassel Road that was in a villa was, you know, fantastic. And then they outgrew that and built a purpose-built school. And so I think, again, I'm not sure if I'm answering that well, Katie. It's always felt like home.
Okay.
Really? Yeah. It's been very welcoming.
Yeah.
Tough times at times, but very welcoming.
Yeah. Should we talk about the OBE?
Why not?
Yeah. Might as well.
Yeah.
Can you, congratulations.
Thank you. Amazing honour.
You were awarded with the OBE in 2022 by King Charles.
That's right.
And can you describe the activities and the service that led to you securing the OBE?
I swear, yeah. I mean, it's an enormous honour, and it was incredibly unexpected. So the honour was given by Her Late Majesty, Queen Elizabeth, in her last New Year's honours, January last year. And the investiture was by His Majesty King Charles, and it was his first investiture. So there's something bittersweet about that whole thing.
Very unique.
But if I go back to that, you know, the story of coming here and being introduced to the British Business Group and the fact that they were based on the grounds of the embassy here, I've always had that great affinity and and pride of being a Brit abroad, that's, you know, for my own purposes, firstly, but then it was sort of a natural progression to create a business that helped not just British companies, but in the main, the nexus was there initially for my business, to help British companies come into market. So the citation for my OBE, or the reason for it, given was services to British business in the UAE. And I couldn't be prouder. So it was a very humbling moment, actually. I remember it was sort of early December of 2021, and I had a call from the then Consul General in Dubai, and he said, John, are you coming by the BBG office today? Because it's in the embassy grounds. And I said, oh, I wasn't planning to, but I can. He said, if you wouldn't mind, you know, come by about 3 o'clock. And I thought, oh, you know, imposter syndrome, paranoia, what have I done? Called to the headmaster's office. So I went to see him, and he personally delivered the letter on behalf of Her Majesty.
Wow, and you had no inkling?
No, none at all. In fact, it was December, early December, and I thought we were going to have a discussion about the BBG Christmas ball, which incidentally is this Saturday, isn't it? Which is on the grounds of the embassy, which is a superb honour. And I thought it was going to be something about that because I was chairman at the time of the BBG and thought maybe, you know, we had to discuss security or things like that. I had no idea at all. So it was amazing surprise. The Consul General said it's the first time he'd ever seen me speechless. but it was true.
So great. Thanks for sharing that. What was the first thing you did when you got the OBE?
Gosh, actually on the day of the investiture.
Yeah. What do you do when you
It's really interesting because I was contacted, you know, by the authorities in the UK to give me a choice, basically, of a date. And there was one date for November at Windsor Castle. Fabulous. Or I could have waited until March this year for Buckingham Palace. And so discussed it with the family and said, well, let's go for Windsor. And the rule is you can take 3 guests.
So I thought, gosh, yeah, that's a tricky one.
Yes. Choose your favourite job. No, lucky we've only got 2 children. So obviously, you know, Carolyn, Chloe and Jack, that's it. Then, my mum, you know, who was desperately proud. And I said to her, look, you know, we're only able to take 3. I'm only able to take 3 guests. And she said, oh, Carolyn will be very disappointed. But I called the St. James's Palace and very, very kindly gave me an extra ticket. Oh, so that was the first thing. So 4 of us trooped up there and it was pouring with rain that day. But as we arrived at the castle, the sun came out like today. And it was one of those magical moments when the sort of everything was glistening because it had just rained, the sun was out. And it was a wonderful experience. And, you know, King Charles himself was remarkably well informed. I was only speaking to him, you know, for a very short period of time, but he knew who I was, what I'd been doing. And I said to him, you know, don't forget, you know, how much, you know, the royal family is fated overseas. So please do come and visit us, Your Majesty. And of course, last week he was here. So. But anyway, I haven't answered your question. What did we went out for lunch. So all of us and then other halves joined us. So I just had a wonderful lunch where I wore the medal throughout.
Oh, really?
Obviously.
Yeah.
And how often do you look at it?
It's every morning tattooed on my chest. Regularly. Yeah. I wear the little emblem regularly.
Nice.
So that's what we did. It was just a wonderful experience. That was in November last year.
It's amazing. So we went to the members, and for every podcast, we asked them to send us questions. So hopefully this one's not too hard for you. This one's come from Dustin, who runs Hemodata.
Great.
So the question is, for businesses looking to enter GCC, why Dubai?
Thanks, Dustin. easy. Infrastructure. The infrastructure of Dubai, UAE generally, but you know, let's look at Dubai in particular. And when I say infrastructure, communication, education, medical, transportation, it's all here. And it's at least, in my view, 10 years ahead of any neighboring country. There are amazing things going on in the kingdom. Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, Oman, all the rest of it. But Dubai is that, in my view, 10 years ahead. So it's the hub and spoke of the region. If you look, Emirates Airline, I think they say here from a transportation point of view, you can reach a third of the world's population within 4 hours, two-thirds within 8 hours. I mean, that's quite incredible for any business, for the physicality of it. So I would say, Dustin, yeah, Dubai has created an infrastructure that is very welcoming to families and businesses. And that's the key for me.
John, you were chair for the BBG for about 5 years, I think it was, wasn't it? And it was, from a personal perspective, a real pleasure working with you in that capacity.
Well, thank you, Katie, likewise.
You're now director for government relations. What changes have you seen in relation to the UAE-UK government relations in your time on the board?
I mean, the historic relations have always been very strong. But I think what really brought it home to me was during the pandemic, and particularly as we came out, the strength of the G2G or government-to-government relationship became palpable. And it was filtered out to the private sector as well, so government to business. And again, I mentioned before, we're based on the embassy ground, so we're very grateful and honoured for that. But for the wider community, it became very clear of the close links of governments and the importance of UAE trade to the UK as part of the GCC collective is really important. So I'd never seen that obvious connection or strength before, and I believe that continues today.
Yeah, and you often meet with Dubai Chamber, for example, and we've got a good working...
Hugely supportive, and the Foreign Investment Office and the Ministry of Economy, and all the various local and federal government entities, as well as, of course, the ruling family themselves. But equally with government and visiting ministers, you can tell the importance of this jurisdiction to UK government and local and federal government alike.
Brill, thanks for being such a great guest, John.
Well, I've enjoyed it. I haven't had a single biscuit.
You will.
Now it's time to open that bad boy up. But yeah, thanks for listening in to the Don't Do That, Do This podcast. Please follow us and share the story and the journey along.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.